Well, thanks very much. I also did the Snowden story as well. So I read a book called The Snowden Files, which has been made into a movie by Oliver Stone, which comes out in September the 17th, at least in the US. Anyone from the US? Yeah, okay, you can see it in the US from September. And I have to say, it's rather good, having seen it, starring Joseph Gordon-Levitt as Snowden. So I've done a series of investigations for The Guardian. I'm also a kind of career foreign correspondent. I spent 12 years doing various beats. I joined The Guardian about two decades ago, but I spent three, four years doing the job in South Asia, covering 9/11 and the wars, George Bush's wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, then followed by a stint as the correspondent in Berlin, covering Europe with side trips to Iraq. And then after that, I was The Guardian's Moscow bureau chief from 2007 until 2011, when I was basically kicked out of the country by Vladimir Putin, who was unhappy about my reporting on taboo stuff, themes like Vladimir Putin's money. He's extremely rich, but one isn't allowed to discuss it. Like the war in southern Russia, which is going on at the moment, massively underreported, but between kind of Islamists, a bit like the Islamists in Iraq, Syria, and local and federal security forces. So I was kicked out. Then subsequently, I was sort of part of a whole series of investigations. In fact, I did the WikiLeaks story while I was still in Moscow and sifted through all of the US sort of diplomatic cables, about 3,000 of them, written by the US ambassador in Moscow and his kind of senior colleagues sent back to the State Department. So I read all of those, covering Russia, covering Belarus, Central Asia, and they came to this kind of very bleak conclusion that Russia under Vladimir Putin had kind of metastasized into a mafia state, which was the title of a book I wrote at the time. I did this book on WikiLeaks arising out of those cables. And then in 2013, I was part of a kind of very small team who basically looked at the Snowden files. So that's, as you know, kind of a whole cache of top secret, beyond top secret documents leaked by Edward Snowden to my newspaper, The Guardian, via Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras and my Guardian colleague Ewan McCaskill in a hotel room in Hong Kong in the summer of 2013, May 2013. I didn't meet Snowden in Hong Kong, but I did look at all this stuff, which was basically, in brief, was reveal the extent to which everybody is being surveilled. In other words, all of your data, all of your text messages, all of your kind of content, it's all been collected, regardless of whether you are an Al-Qaeda operative or just a 20-year-old student. That's something we now know about, thanks to Edward Snowden. We know that this little device here is the greatest spying device ever invented. Snowden's tip was to put your iPhone in your fridge if you want to have a kind of private conversation. And we know that all sorts of things which previously would have seemed ridiculous, some kind of paranoid left-wing fantasy, turned out to be true because Snowden showed us the documents. So, for example, the fact that the little web camera on your laptop can actually be remotely activated and turned into a camera which looks at you. Again, sounds crazy, but we reviewed the documents and that is indeed what happens, and it's being spearheaded by GCHQ, which is the British equivalent of NSA. So I did all of these stories. They were fascinating. The WikiLeaks disclosures were cables, basically telegrams written by American diplomats who went to Harvard or Yale or Princeton. They were the most kind of aesthetically rich. They were written in English. You could read them. They were analytical. They were clever. They were sometimes even literary. So that was that leak, which at the time we thought was going to be the biggest leak we would ever see in our lifetimes. Then, of course, along came the Snowden files, which was a huge volume of hundreds of thousands of top secret documents, many of which were quite technical. They were hard to read. Some of them were written as if a robot had written them. They involved kind of esoteric program names. They involved high degree of mathematics in some cases. I mean, they were really hard to kind of decipher. But we were convinced that again there would be no other leak like it in the summer of 2013. I think in terms of the significance of what Snowden said, the significance of that leak, I think it's the biggest, most important leak of the 21st century, without a doubt. But if we then fast forward to last year, 2015, along came another leak called the Panama Papers, and you can see that's actually the Guardian's homepage behind me, theguardian.com, news/Panama-Papers. You can see all of our reporting there. And the Panama Papers was again another kind of extraordinary leak, which in some ways surpassed the two previous mega leaks. First of all, in terms of volume, so we're talking about 11.5 million documents. It's the biggest leak ever. It's the biggest data set that's ever been released ever. And it was basically the internal database of a Panamanian law firm called Mossack Fonseca, which previously no one had ever heard of, but actually is one of the biggest offshore companies in the world, and moreover was probably among the super rich, among crooks, among oligarchs, among sort of corrupt politicians, former dictators. It was the sort of law firm of choice because it was renowned, infamous, for not asking any questions about its clients, for offering all sorts of exotic structures whereby the beneficiaries would never be known. So we had 11.5 million documents from Mossack Fonseca, and the circumstances of the leak itself are kind of amazing, because with WikiLeaks we had Chelsea Manning, whom we know is doing 30 years in the US jail, who was behind the leak and was arrested in 2010. With Edward Snowden, we had this extraordinary video, which I'm sure you've all seen, about Snowden deciding to out himself, reveal himself from his Hong Kong bedroom and hotel room in the Mirror Hotel and say to the world, "I am Edward Snowden. I did this because I was kind of..." Basically, I felt that the US authorities, that the intelligence community had overreached itself and was behaving in unconstitutional ways without the consent of the American people or indeed anybody else, and had switched from a model of surveilling or spying on bad guys to surveilling and spying on everybody in this room. So that was Snowden, who kind of came out, did the leak, and then explained why he'd done it, and is now stuck in Moscow. But the Panama Papers leaker, we don't know who that is. So this is someone, it could be he, it could be she, it could be a they. Actually, I think it is a he or a she, probably a he, but we don't know. Were inspired by Snowden, but have taken a different route, which is entirely understandable, given generally what happens to whistleblowers, that things go very badly wrong for them once they are exposed. And this particular whistleblower called himself, herself, John Doe, and got in touch early last year with Süddeutsche Zeitung, which is a German newspaper based in Munich, with a kind of investigations department, two very accomplished journalists who run it, both called Obermeier, although they're not related, Bastian and Frederick Obermeier. And I read the foreword to their book, which was published last week in the UK, and it's called The Panama Papers. And they've written it as I would have written it. All my books are non-fiction thrillers. They've done the same. And it starts with Bastian sitting at home, surrounded by domestic chaos, with his kids being sick, looking in front of his laptop like you are, and suddenly a message pings up saying, "Interested in secret data?" ? And you can already see the Hollywood movie kind of coalescing around this sort of storyline. And Bastian, being a bit of a cool cat, type back, "Always interested in secret data, what is it?" So that was Bastian's reply. And then there was a kind of, you know, there was a sort of ping pong between the source and Bastian. Bastian still had no idea who it was, but the source sent some sort of sample documents. And they were fascinating. They were basically Mossack Fonseca's internal database. So that means things like emails between this law firm and their clients, who are not necessarily the rich people directly. They're quite often intermediary legal firms, accountancy firms, and so on. And this is a kind of global industry which spans everywhere, in which Britain is heavily involved through Britain's own little kind of tax islands, crown dependencies like Jersey and Guernsey and the Isle of Man, and what are called overseas territories, which sort of sit south of the US and the Caribbean, things like the British Virgin Islands, Bermuda, and so on, where essentially what you can do is you can open up an anonymous company, it can hold a bank account, it can do all sorts of stuff for you, and instead of you being the person who's publicly named as being associated with that company, you have what are called nominees. In other words, people who've got nothing to do with it, but who pretend to be the directors of your company. And while it's not illegal, I mean, there are legitimate reasons for doing this, it's also a perfect kind of vehicle for kind of the open minds call them scumbags, for the world's kind of leading scumbags with us. Drug dealers, crooks, corrupt people from former Soviet Union and so on. And so there was this sort of ping pong between Bastion and the source, and it became pretty clear that this was an enormous leak and that actually it was going to need a kind of international team of journalists to deal with it. So what Süddeutsche Zeitung did was that they got in touch with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, the ICIJ, which is based in Washington, D.C., which had done previous offshore leaks, though nothing on this scale. And the ICIJ put together a kind of team of reporters to look at this. And this turned out to be the biggest investigative collaboration that anyone has ever done. So by the time we got round to publishing, which was on the 3rd of April of this year, there were about 380 journalists working on the story globally from 100 media organisations in 80 different countries. So, does anyone come from a really small country here? Yeah, where do you come from?
Singapore.
That's actually not a very small country, but anyway, but Singapore journalists, journalists from practically every part of the world were involved in this. And what's interesting about it is that traditionally, if you have a great story, you're a journalist, you don't share it, right? You try and scoop everybody else and defeat, slay the opposition and do glorious stuff. Whereas this was a different model whereby we were working in little sort of Leninist cells, little groups focusing on particular areas, particular countries. So I was looking at particularly Russia and Ukraine, so corruption there, but other people were looking at, Latin America or football or Formula One or yachts or the art world, or because this offshore kind of industry just spreads into all aspects of the kind of global economy. And the ICIJ sort of set up two very kind of neat things to help us with our investigation. One was a search engine called Blacklight, whereby you could take any phrase. Let's say you take Charlie Beckett. You put Charlie Beckett into Blacklight. You search and you see whether Charlie Beckett has got any offshore companies. Actually, Charlie, I haven't done that, but I'll do that afterwards, just to see if you feature in data at all. And then you would get a whole load of results. And quite often you get numerous kind of false positives, depending on what your search term was. But we got better at it. We started looking for particular search terms. We learned the kind of vocabulary of this kind of weird sort of in the dark industry, like, for example, PEP, which means politically exposed person, anyone who plays a sort of role in political life, and not just them, but also their relatives and friends and so on. So we would look for PEPs, because that was quite a good source of stories. We would look for, kind of words like embarrassing. We would look for words like beneficial owner, which meant the real person behind the offshore company. It was pretty complicated work, but the second piece of furniture that ICIJ came up with is something called the iHub, which became like a sort of secret Facebook for the journalists involved in this project, whereby you could join groups, you would post tips, you would link to documents that you'd found in the database, and you would get regular updates from the ICIJ. And this was great, and it was pretty, I mean, we took our security very seriously. So we were working back in the Guardian sort of bunker, secret bunker, where we looked at the Snowden files. We were very careful about who had access to this. We had access codes, which we had to get. Then we had, I don't know if anyone uses this, but then we had sort of an authenticator code as well, which changes every 30 seconds, which you get. So really, the only way to hack in would be either to be a very sophisticated nation state or to get someone from the project, get their login codes and kidnap them and have their iPhone, then you could get in. So it was very secure, And it really kind of very fruitful. We had a sort of series of clandestine meetings where again, we were behaving as if we were kind of, you know, some kind of, secret underground network, but we met in DC, we met in Munich, we met most recently in London in December of last year. And we were, there were sort of two concerns really when we were doing this project. One was that the leak would itself leak. I mean, if you've got 380 journalists, basically to get a secret out of a journalist, all you have to do is like take them for a drink and buy them a beer. And then they will tell you everything that they've, you know, everything and anything. It's very, very easy to do. But, you know, amazingly, the leak didn't leak. No one tweeted it. We were writing all our stories. We were involved in a very arduous legal process. Because obviously, if you're exposing someone's secret bank account, you need to have a pretty good kind of public interest reason for doing it. Because many people in this database were actually not guilty of any crime. They were what you might call the kind of non-famous international rich, but also there were lots of heads of state there, people on the Forbes 100, billionaires, crooks of every description, chancers, Ponzi schemers, paedophiles, the whole lot. but we had to kind of consider in each case what the public interest rationale was for writing about them, and also we had to do this kind of process of due diligence whereby we would write to someone. We would send them these apocalyptic letters saying, we know that you are a crook, you are a murderer, you've done this, that, and the other. And then we would just wait for the howls of protest and the very, very threatening letters from London libel firms saying, you know, you publish this, we're going to sue you and, you know, make sure you never publish again. So there was all this. And the other anxiety we had was about reception, about whether anyone would remotely care about offshore, like who cares about offshore. And in fact, actually the leak was, it was massive. This global publishing model helped. We all did co-publish on the 3rd of April in our different time zones. For reasons which I still don't entirely understand, Edward Snowden discovered Süddeutsche Zeitung's English language site, which hadn't actually been launched but was up and running, and he tweeted it about 15 minutes early. So Snowden basically broke the story in a way, and once Snowden had tweeted it to his 2 million followers, we all kind of like crashed this story out. And it turned out to be huge. I mean, there were immediate kind of ramifications. In this country, there were big ramifications because David Cameron, the soon-to-be ex-British Prime Minister, his late father Ian had a Panama-registered kind of, basically a sort of trust investment company in the Bahamas. And we knew about this, but there were new details in the Panama Papers which were embarrassing. It turned out that Cameron's father had not paid any UK tax on this fund for 30 years. David Cameron initially didn't want to talk about it. He got very cross. He had a sort of disastrous media week where he then sort of came out with a statement saying that he will not benefit, you know, in the future from this trust, which everyone realised meant that he had done so in the past. And finally, on day four, he came clean and admitted that he'd been a beneficiary and that he'd sold his shares in Dad's offshore firm for £30,000 just before he became Prime Minister. So that was his worst ever week until last week, which really was his worst ever week, and when he resigned having given us this disastrous referendum and basically wrecked the country. So that's my brief political point for this morning. So in the UK it was the front page story everywhere. In Iceland, the Icelandic Prime Minister had a secret offshore company which he hadn't declared or registered. There's a wonderful GIF which Snowden tweeted of the Icelandic Prime Minister being ambushed on camera and asked about this firm, and you can see his sort of face kind of looking, you know, sort of kind of shocked and not knowing how to reply. There were demonstrations outside the parliament in Reykjavik with Icelanders throwing bananas at the parliament building to symbolise that Iceland had become a banana republic. apparently they grow bananas in Iceland. I didn't realise that, but they do, I've been told. There were protests in Argentina against the Argentinian president, who also had an offshore company, which sent a new centre-right president, which he failed to mention during the election campaign. And I think the biggest story, actually, of all, even though it had less public resonance, was the story I've been working on in Russia, which was essentially we discovered that there was someone called Sergei Roldugin, who was who said that he was just a humble cellist with an orchestra in St. Petersburg with no assets, small kind of cottage, et cetera, second-hand car. And we found transactions, numerous transactions, more than 200, going into offshore companies, either directly owned by him or linked to him, managed by a Russian state bank called Bank Masir, with the money then going offshore to Cyprus and elsewhere and being cycled back into Russia, into media projects and various other endeavours. And we discovered that Sergei Roldugin was in fact Vladimir Putin's best friend, that he'd known him since 1977, that he'd introduced Putin to Putin's wife, Ludmila, when they went on a double date, that he was godfather to Putin's oldest daughter, and he was one of relatively few people who, after 2014 and Russia's annexation of Crimea, who had escaped sanctions. And essentially he was being used as a proxy by the people who kind of managed Putin's financial affairs as a way of kind of getting around sanctions and money laundering and so on. And so of course in Russia, which is a sort of postmodern soft dictatorship, Putin didn't resign, but the story was kind of very embarrassing for him. I've spent almost 10 years looking at kind of Putin's money, and while we didn't find all of Putin's money, far from it, we found one $2 billion scheme which we could document quite calmly, quite dispassionately, involving numerous mechanisms of the state and Putin's friends. So we did some great stories. I mean, you can see them all there if you have a look afterwards. I did that piece there inside the firm that helps the super rich hide their money, which was a kind of profile of the company, and also some of the more inventive strategies that the company is using to help its clients. What's quite amusing, I mean, there are moments of humour in the story too, is that the sort of super rich have got increasingly nervous. I would say over the last sort of 7 or 8 years that there have been moves, not very successful moves, by the OECD, by the G20, by the US, to try and clamp down on offshore kind of tax evasion. And so we find the super rich doing things like coming up with fake names so that when they call their lawyer, they were, instead of saying, "Hey, it's John here," they would say, "Hey, it's Winnie the Pooh." Or we found Winnie the Pooh, we found Harry Potter, we found Isaac Asimov, we found a whole people using sort of a series of names. And we also found evidence from private emails which were released that the super rich were being so scared that instead of taking their rolls out when they were driving around Switzerland or Sardinia or Italy, they would take their second-hand car because they're worried that the tax police would see that their assets were not commensurate with their declared income. So that was all kind of very interesting. There were various sports stories as well, which I looked into. I think it was a great moment. I think it was a great moment for sort of caught the world's attention for a week, which is quite hard to do. To catch the attention of everybody for a week. So I think the story was important. I mean, David Cameron had an anti-corruption summit in May of this year. I think he's haunted to an extent by by the ghost of his late father, so he was sort of genuinely keen to kind of do some reforms and to bring about greater transparency. But there's a question mark about whether that will happen in the overseas territories like the British Virgin Islands. And the other thing I would say before we go to questions is it was kind of really good kind of investigation, because I don't know if you know the global picture, but basically the media industry, both in the US and in the UK and indeed everywhere else, is in enormous trouble. Newsrooms are downsizing. We lost £50 million last year. We've just had 250 redundancies, some commercial, some editorial. Basically, the model, which used to exist 20 years ago when physical newspapers were still in big circulations, is broken. And all of the money from advertising on newspapers, or practically all of it, is going to Facebook and to Google. And so independent news organisations are struggling to make this work. And so in a way, if you have a model where you've got 300-350 journalists who kind of collaborate internationally, that spreads the cost, and it means you get a much, much better result. So I think it was a good investigation, and I would just say sort of finally that, how many of you do actually want to be journalists? Anyone else be a journalist? Maybe a journalist. And you definitely a journalist, okay. Well, it's kind of, you know, it's interesting how the model's changed. I mean, has anyone seen All the President's Men? The great sort of 1970s film with Dustin Hoffman? Yeah, playing Woodward and Bernstein, bringing down Nixon. You know the one I'm talking about, yeah? Yeah, you know some history, you guys, right? So Nixon, yeah, okay. Well, I mean, then the kind of the kind of Hollywood model of the investigative journalist was someone who kind of knocked on doors, met sources in underground car parks, used a lot of shoe leather in chasing down a story, et cetera, et cetera. And I would say now the kind of investigative journalist is almost certainly, I mean, you need all that, of course you do. You do need to meet sources and all the rest of it, but it's now become a kind of geek, probably with glasses, with a laptop, with a big data set, with a skinny latte on the side. That is the 21st century big data, big information world. So if any of you want to be journalists, make sure you know how to deal with big numbers, big data sets, because that's the way it's going to go, and there are going to be more leaks. Thank you. And now I will answer questions on anything you would like to talk about. Yeah, hi. Yeah.
Okay. So I have a question about... So I'm interested in how The Guardian and other like media organizations have set themselves up to receive information like this, and has this changed some sort of like business model to, I guess, receive information? Because like I think encryption software like that you were talked about would be, you know, really expensive. So I'm wondering like what you guys have done for it.
How we do it? Well, I mean, various methods. I mean, we do have an encryption platform where people can leak us stuff, you know, can securely leak to us. But what's quite interesting, one thing, the source wrote a kind of manifesto after he, she, you know, did this leak about 2 weeks later, which was kind of fascinating, all about why they'd done it. But John Doe also revealed that he, she had approached various media organisations, some of whom had reviewed this stuff, and also tried very hard to get in contact with WikiLeaks, you know, which is basically a one-man band, Julian Assange, who's around the corner in the Ecuadorian embassy, not far from here. You can go and see him later if you want. And had submitted to the kind of, you know, the WikiLeaks kind of encrypted sort of chat platform, and no one had replied. So that is the problem, and it is very difficult because, as you know, email is no longer private. So if you send an open email, that's not necessarily going to work. Most people are not. I mean, we use encryption a lot. That's one of the big changes of the last few years, is we've gone from not using encryption to using encryption all the time, and also doing a lot more face-to-face meetings. But not everyone is good at encryption. I mean, we use PGP. Again, if you're interested in journalism, or even if you're interested in privacy, it's worth having a look at PGP. It's free. You can download it. You just swap your public key with someone. But not everyone knows how to do that, and that's the problem. The danger is that it becomes very, very easy for governments, for the police, for the authorities to kind of track down your source, and obviously then arrest your source, and so on. So the whole issue of source protection, I think, is kind of very huge. There have been a couple of cases in this country where journalists have had a source inside the police force, for example, and the police have then seized their telecommunications data, identified the source, and then gone after the source. And absolutely, the sort of whistleblower protection in this country is not good enough at all. I mean, the other problem is, as well as the whole platform issue, is that I get people all the time who come up to me with stories, and most of the time, what they say is kind of, it just doesn't check out. I mean, it's quite often people who approach you saying, "We've got the most amazing story," are a bit nuts. You know, I mean, someone talked to me on Friday and said that they found Donald Trump's money, which they may have done, it's possible, but probably they haven't, you know. And so the one anxiety is how you protect your source. You know, it's extremely unusual for someone to send you a message saying, "Are you interested in secret data?" and it turns out to be the Panama Papers. But it does happen. So how you protect your source, and secondly, how you find out without wasting your entire day or week or month, whether the material is worth it.
Yeah. An interesting point you just made about some other things I was thinking about was, in a way, why isn't there more leaking? You know, that people would be inspired by it, Snowden, Manning, etc. There'd be more leaking. I wondered, sort of, do you think that there is more disclosure going on? You just mentioned that you get nutty people sort of coming to you. Do you think that there is more
Yeah, I think there is, although not perhaps so much in this country. But I mean, I think technologically it's become much easier. I mean, if you look at the kind of famous British spies of the 50s and 60s who'd been basically spying for the Soviet Union from the mid to late 1930s onwards, people like, you know, Burgess and Maclean and so on. I mean, they were stuffing, you know, a briefcase full of documents and passing them to their kind of Russian handlers, or laboriously taking photographs. That wasn't a terribly efficient way of doing it, but that was the only way of doing it. I mean, now, you know, we live in this sort of digital age where we don't quite know how Snowden exfiltrated the crown jewels from the NSA, but we think probably he was an IT guy, right? He was a sysadmin. He had access to the entire system, and we think probably he wrote quite sophisticated web crawling programs which allowed him to kind of hoover all this material up. So, but the volume is incomparable compared to the kind of pre-internet age. So the Panama Papers was 2.6 terabytes. It would take 27 years to read all the documents. I mean, it's just, which is why we needed that kind of great search engine to kind of look at stuff. It's just an astonishing volume of information that one couldn't fit in the whole of LSE in printed form. I mean, you need half of London to do it. And so, certainly the leaks are bigger. And I think maybe there is a kind of snowball effect. I mean, I think people are inspired for doing it, but generally whistleblowers have got kind of clear ideological reasons for doing it. So, in Britain, we seem to be. I mean, my most recent book was on the murder of Alexander Litvinenko, who was a kind of Russian dissident, former intelligence guy who fled from Moscow to London in 2000, was a huge critic of Vladimir Putin's, and was poisoned in 2006 with a radioactive cup of tea containing this absolutely lethal nuclear substance called polonium. I don't know if you know about this case or not, and died in agony 23 days later. And we have absolutely everything on this case. We have there was a public inquiry last year. We have material from Scotland Yard. We have material, forensics material. We had 62 witnesses, 10,000 pages of evidence. But what we haven't got is we haven't got stuff from the government, from the British security agencies. That's MI5 and MI6. It's the sort of equivalent of the CIA and the FBI. And I've been waiting for someone to leak me this stuff for a very long time. In my book, I've even put an appeal at the back asking for someone to send me a brown envelope with these documents, because Litvinenko, before he died, was working on a consultancy basis for MI6, for the British spy agency. It was earning £2,000 a month. And moreover, when he was poisoned, the MI6 didn't notice. He had a handler who spoke Russian. They would have all these clandestine meetings in Waterston's bookshop. I don't know if anyone's been to Waterston's, but I mean, you know, and so on and so on. And this is like the sort of missing piece, and no one will leak it. It hasn't leaked. Even his widow doesn't know what precisely the government knows. And so I think the picture is mixed. I think it's a golden age for investigative journalism. I think there will be more leaks undoubtedly, but there seems to be something about the British character that we are less willing to leak material, especially from UK institutions, than in America, where there's this great kind of intellectual tradition of dissent, of mistrusting the state, of Thoreau, of sort of thinking basically the government is separate or bad. I mean, in this country, we tend to trust the government. And Also, we have James Bond, you know, we have this great super spy. So people sort of think, oh, well, you know, James Bond, you know, Queen and Country, Queen jumping out of a helicopter at the London Olympics in 2012, James Bond saving the day. And so we tend to give our agencies, our intelligence agencies, our governments, our people in authority, we give them the benefit of the doubt, despite the fact that we have this kind of mocking, lampooning culture of Monty Python and everything else. We sort of trust the state, whereas I think in the US, there's a culture of not trusting the state or rebelling against the state or finding intellectual reasons for disobeying the state, as Snowden did, which means that the US is a kind of more fertile territory for leaking.